the seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras Iglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohamed Abu Salmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Sometimes hunger can make you to be brave. For me to risk my life to go down there, I think I have went through some serious thought to say that, but let me risk it for my family to give them ends meet.
That's Tande Kazizi Tom wishing her brother, who is one of 100 of miners still trapped in an abandoned gold mine in South Africa, would be rescued. Details coming up also. Famine is reported to be spreading in Sudan amid relentless war between the military and the paramilitary group. And new data shows that Africa's continued coal dependency will threaten not just the continent, but the entire planet. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Hundreds of illegal miners trapped in an abandoned gold mine in Stilfontein in South Africa's northwest province will spend Christmas Day underground. The government has yet to begin a promised rescue mission. Families of those underground are angry and disappointed. Tusoko Malo reports from Johannesburg.
For the first time, Tande Kazizi Tom will spend Christmas Day without her brother Ayanda Tom. He is one of the hundreds of illegal miners who have spent months in an abandoned gold mine in Stilfontein. When the government announced over a month ago that a team of mine rescue experts had been assembled to rescue the miners, Tandeka says she was hopeful the return of her brother alive would be the best Christmas gift. She is unhappy with the government's position that her brother and others with him are criminals violating laws against illegal mining.
Sometimes hunger can make you to be brave. For me to risk my life to go down there, I think I have went through some serious thought to say that, but let me risk it for my family to give them ends meet.
The government rescue team has not yet begun the actual rescue mission. 2 weeks ago, Police Commissioner General Fanny Masemola told the media that the government will need up to $54,000 a day to carry out the rescue, and the government is still working on securing the funds. Lina Minyuzeya is distraught. Her two sons, Tinashe and Tawanda, will not be joining her at the Christmas dinner table this year. They have been underground since February.
Just like I'm crazy. I don't know. Because, you know, I don't know what I'm talking. But it's too much. It's too much. What I want my children. Yeah.
Johannes Kankase, a community leader in Stilfontein, says the government gave them false hope that it would rescue the miners.
It's very painful to us as community leaders. As concerned community leaders, it's very painful. It's very devastating because we must understand we had hope when the government said it's going to enhance or intervene in resurfacing the people underground. But to date, nothing has happened.
Mameshwe Sebei, a human rights lawyer, wants the government to stop telling people that the miners are free to resurface. He says those miners who have voluntarily resurfaced have explained why many are not coming out.
I see that government is engaged in whole propaganda of, you know, falsification of the actual situation here. They tell people, well, people can come out when they want. But the reality is, those tunnels are flooded. Many of these people are extremely weak, being emaciated, being dehydrated, being extremely weakened by lack of medication. And the idea that these people can just easily crawl their way to that other side is not realistic.
Initially, many of the men who were working in the mine illegally refused to come out because they did not want to be arrested. Wessels Moreng, Northwest member of the Executive Council responsible for safety, defended the police for refusing to go down into the mine to force out the miners. He says Cameras sent down the shaft revealed that there are heavily armed people underground. President Cyril Ramaphosa has said the illegal miners will be dealt with humanely, but said that upon resurfacing, they will be arrested and prosecuted because they had committed a criminal act. South Africa bans mining in pits that mining companies have abandoned because they had become unprofitable. The government says illegal mining is dangerous and is often run by gangs. In addition, the government loses millions of rands a year in revenue from ore sold illegally. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Thuso Khumalo.
Chad's Electoral Commission has asked the Central African States military to help protect election officials and candidates amid a spike in attacks on campaign teams ahead of the December 29th elections. While no shooting have been reported, witnesses say opposition supporters have used clubs and iron bars to prevent the ruling MP's party from holding rallies in several cities and towns. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
The National Election Management Agency in Chad, known as ANJ, says campaigning for the December 29 parliamentary, local council and regional elections has been plagued by attempts to disrupt rallies and by attacks on candidates and elections officials. Chadian officials say the elections will mark an end to the Central African State's three-year so-called transitional period following the April 2021 death of former longtime president Idriss Deby Itno. Hassan Bayria is ANJ's vice president.
L'Agence nationale de gestion des élections sollicite votre contribution.
Bayra says the elections management body she represents this week officially requested Chad's military to be deployed to try to protect civilians, candidates, officials, and national and international observers before, during, and after the nation's December 29 elections. She says ongoing tensions may degenerate into armed conflicts if Chad's military fails to deploy troops to protect campaign caravans and candidates representing political parties taking part in the polls. ANJ says more than 8.3 million of Chad's about 18 million civilians have registered to vote. About 180 political parties have put forward nearly 1,300 candidates to compete in the country's parliamentary elections alone, with several thousand others to take part in local council and provincial elections, according to Chad's government. More than 1,000 election observers have been accredited for the polls. However, a coalition of over 75 opposition parties and civil society groups described the planned polls as a masquerade, saying that Chadian President Mahamat Idriss Deby and his Patriotic Salvation Movement, or MPS, are planning to use the polls to consolidate their grip on power. Opposition and civil society groups say their supporters this week used clubs and iron bars to attack MPS campaign caravans in several towns, including Djamena, Bongor, Abeche, Lai, and Mundu. In other areas, the military says it has dismantled roadblocks set up by opposition parties to prevent MPS campaigners from entering towns. Avuksuma Jonah, president of Chad's Party of Democrats, says his supporters have been blocking campaigners from both MPS and the opposition from holding election rallies.
Vous avez l'ange avec sa structure. Vous avez...
Avuksuma says his party wants elections to be postponed because all the officials of Chad's elections management body are appointed by Deby, who rules with an iron fist and is not ready to make Chad a democratic state. He says Deby controls Chad's constitutional court and has instructed officials of the court to declare his party victorious in all elections. ANJ organizes elections and declares provisional results according to Chad's laws. The country's constitutional court declares final results. Debbie appoints officials to both institutions. Debbie told State TV this week that elections for Chad to fully return to civilian rule will be fair and transparent. Opposition groups quickly dismissed that claim, saying the Chadian leader wants to rig the polls to ensure control of parliament. Debbie became Chad's transitional president in April 2021 after his father, Idris Debbie Itno, was killed in a gun battle with rebels following 30 years in power. He promised an 18-month transition to civilian rule, but extended it by 2 years. Debbie won Chad's contested May 6 presidential polls, which many opposition parties boycotted, asserting that Debbie wanted at all costs to continue his late father's rule. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Yehayes Wuhib, in Washington. Famine is reported to be spreading in Sudan amid relentless war between the military and the paramilitary group that wrecked the country and created the world's largest displacement crisis. A report by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, says famine has been detected in 5 areas in the northeastern African country. The Associated Press reports that 5 other areas in North Darfur are projected with reasonable evidence to experience famine in the next 6 months. Sudan has been roiled by a war since April 2023, which has killed more than 24,000 people and driven over 14 million people from their homes. In 2024, lobby groups from Africa's coal sector regularly made a case for the continent to continue to burn the fossil fuel to generate electricity until stocks are depleted. These groups argue Africa's development would slow if it abandons coal, and it's unfair to expect it to do so when rich countries had centuries of coal used to build their economies. New data, however, show that Africa's continued coal dependency will threaten not just the continent, but the entire planet. Darren Taylor reports.
Alize Leroux of South Africa's Center for Industrial and Scientific Research is one of the continent's leading geoinformatics scientists. For the past 3 years, she's collected and analyzed data to determine Africa's climate and energy future. Leroux's study shows the continent needs a mix of renewable, nuclear, and gas power going forward, and that long-term burning of coal will be damaging. Currently, says the scientist, Africa produces less than 5% of the carbon gases that heat the earth, causing the extreme weather that sparks intense droughts and floods.
We are expecting that emissions will peak at around 2033, then it will plateau and then it will slowly start declining. Africa's share, however, of global emissions is set to increase significantly. So currently 5%, the continent will contribute roughly around 11% by 2050, mid-century, and then potentially reaching 16% by 2063. So this trend, I think, really highlights Africa's growing role in global emissions, and it underscores the urgency of a transition to cleaner energy sources.
Should African nations continue on the current trajectory of large-scale coal burning, says Leroux, the continent will replace China as the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in 2065, with almost 30% of global output. She says Africa will soon be the only continent where emissions are rising. This is despite the rollout of renewable energy systems such as solar farms to replace coal-fired power stations in some of Africa's worst carbon polluters. But while countries such as South Africa are making progress, says LaRue, carbon outputs in Democratic Republic of Congo, Egypt and Nigeria are increasing significantly.
So Nigeria's contribution by mid-century is expected to be around 20% of Africa's contribution. And this rise in emissions really is the result of factors such as rapid population growth and expanded industrial activity and rising energy demands. So Nigeria, specifically for Africa, because of its large oil and gas resources, will really be a major player on the continent in terms of contributing to this problem. Actually, we are forecasting that by mid-century, Nigeria on its own would contribute around 4% of global emissions from fossil fuels.
South African environmental researcher Kgalego Mkumbeni describes Africa's continued use of fossil fuels as self-destruction. But, she adds, richer countries have a responsibility to pay Africa to keep its coal and oil in the ground.
I think we need about $15 billion annually for adaptation on the continent. And Africa receives, I think, less than 4% of global funding when it comes to climate finance, which is so little considering the fact that we lack the institutional capacity to deal with adaptation. So you already see that there is a substantial funding gap.
Mkumbeni says it's entirely possible for Africa to industrialize and develop using only clean energy. But this dream scenario, as she puts it, won't be realized without trillions of dollars in financing, money that Africa alone will never come up with. Last month at the United Nations Climate Summit in Azerbaijan, wealthy nations pledged to triple the amount of climate mitigation funds available for developing nations to $300 billion starting in 2026. Climate activists and some world leaders, however, said even that amount would be too little. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
In his first term as U.S. president, Donald Trump tightened economic sanctions against North Korea to try to force Pyongyang to give up its nuclear weapons program. VOA's Yang Gayo Kim looks at what Trump should expect from North Korea in his second term. Scott Stearns narrates.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un used a military exhibition for his first remarks on the United States since Donald Trump became president-elect, saying past negotiations confirmed what he called Washington's unchangeable hostility toward Pyongyang. Kim vowed to expand North Korea's nuclear capabilities without limit as the only way to counter external threats. Kim today is a decidedly different opponent for Trump than when they last met in 2019, says former State Department Asian Affairs official Evans Revere.
Kim Jong-un believes he has a stronger hand, and I believe part of that stronger hand is his newfound relationship with the Russians.
U.S. military officials say there are now more than 10,000 North Korean troops in Russia helping with its invasion of Ukraine. Russian Defense Minister Andrei Belousov was in Pyongyang last month advancing a strategic partnership treaty that Belousov says reduces the risk of war on the Korean Peninsula. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte says that alliance is a challenge for the incoming Trump administration.
A nuclear technology, a missile technology is flowing into North Korea and therefore is a risk now that North Korea will use it, not only to be a threat to us here, but also to the U.S. mainland.
Together, Russia and North Korea threaten greater instability, says former U.S. National Intelligence Officer for North Korea, Sidney Seiler.
This is becoming a military alliance with both near-term and longer-term dangerous risk to obviously extending the war in Ukraine, destabilizing the Korean Peninsula, and just destabilizing the international community.
With North Korea gaining Russian air defense systems, upgraded munitions manufacturing, cash, and food and fuel aid, Seiler says Kim has less need for Washington than during Trump's first term.
With all the things that Kim Jong-un is able to get from his new best friend, Vladimir Putin, why would he reach out to Donald Trump?
In his first term, Trump worked with South Korean leaders to try to roll back North Korea's nuclear weapons program. In his second term, Trump will be dealing with a North Korea that has firmly closed the door on denuclearization, says Revere.
What the North Koreans have been after all the while is to gain acceptance from the United States, or at least acknowledgement from the United States, that North Korea is a legitimate, accepted nuclear power now, and that the two countries should sit down together and talk and coexist with each other.
Just days before last month's U.S. election, North Korea tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile that could potentially reach most of the U.S. mainland. For Young-gyo Kim, Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Now, for all our listeners preparing for the holiday season and the new year, we have some greetings from Accra, Ghana, brought to us by journalist Prince Benjamin.
Hello, my name is Deborah Adijeyi, the CEO of Royal Range Supermarkets, and I am so excited about this festive season because of the birth of Jesus Christ and giving and taking of gifts. And actually, this is my first Christmas as a business owner, a supermarket owner. And I'm so excited to meet my new customers, my old ones, and giving discounts and interacting with new people. I'm saying Merry Christmas and a prosperous New Year. I'm saying a shout out to my friends, my family, my loved ones, to everyone around the world. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Thank you. Bye.
Hi, my name is Kokui Salome. I'm a creative professional. I've worked in the media, I'm a musician, and I'm here to say Merry Christmas, first and foremost, and secondly, that this is the season of giving, of love, of newness, of fresh things, and as we celebrate the Christmas season and we move into 2025, I would just like to hope that all of us are moving forward with a sense of optimism, with a sense of renewal, and that whatever we're going into 2025 with, we leave the negativity behind and we move forward with positivity. It's a new era. It's a chance to try new things. And in line with trying new things, I think let's all challenge ourselves in 2025 to maybe try something you've been scared to do in the past. I mean, there's no time like the present, right? So why not take 2025 as that year of renewal, trying new things, and just moving forward fearlessly and without inhibitions I think that's a good way to move into 2025 and to celebrate the Christmas season. So put all the negativity aside, enjoy life, it's short, tomorrow isn't promised, and let's look forward to great things as the new year comes around.
I'm Max, I'm a swimming instructor. I do swimming lessons at Jazz Court Hotel from Tuesday to Sunday. Swimming is a life-saving thing and a very good thing for you to do or everybody to learn. What I have to say is about Christmas. I love Christmas. Christmas is a very nice thing and it's a very good thing. And we give praise to Almighty for giving us his beloved son Jesus Christ to die for us. And I also thank everybody that enjoyed Christmas and love Christmas. Christmas is a very good thing for meeting strangers that treat you like they know you, and for the gifts that we have and the gift that we collect from people from Christmas. Happy Merry Christmas to everyone that's watching me. Bye.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Ihayus Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van D, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.